You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 11th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Canada claims China's been up to electoral jiggery-pokery. And does the European Migration and Asylum Agreement make anyone happy? I'm Guy Delaunay. The Monocle Daily starts now. Greetings and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Guy Delaunay. My guests Isabel Hilton and Enrico Franceschini will discuss the day's big stories. We'll be hearing how the land of the rising sun is heading for the moon as Japan strikes a lunar rover deal with the US. Closer to home, make your travel plans for Italy as the government opens up La Dolce Vita to digital nomads. And we'll wrap up everything with a letter from Milan. Stay tuned, all that coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily, and whatever it says in the script, I'm Guy Delaunay, not Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by Isabel Hilton, the founder of China Dialogue and a visiting professor at King's College London's Lau Institute. Also by Enrico Franceschini, the London correspondent for La Repubblica. Greetings.
Good evening.
I raised the spectre and I saw you smile, Enrico, so there's no excuse. You're not getting out of this. I raised the spectre of La Dolce Vita in...
My favourite movie.
Thank goodness for that. And one of Ebert and Siskel said that it's a film that you should watch throughout your life at different points, because as you change, the film changes.
Well, that's the magic of Fellini, right?
It isn't. Have you found this to be true, if it's your favourite film?
Well, it is really, because it's the story of a journalist, after all. And so a journalist can only dream to have an adventure like the protagonist in Rome.
Every film with journalists in it is automatically good. Is it a favourite of yours, Isabel?
Absolutely. I haven't watched it for a while. But now you've nudged me, perhaps I will take up this habit of watching it repeatedly.
Nudge applied. And on a cultural tip, which might be more sort of professionally up your alley, at any rate, I've been waiting for The Three Body Problem to come out on Netflix. I haven't yet watched it. Have you, and should I?
Well, you should, not least. It is one of the few Chinese novels that broke through into international celebrity. It's now, as you say, on Netflix. So as a cultural phenomenon, you should watch it. Also because it's caused the most unholy row in China, where they absolutely hate it.
Excellent.
You should see it.
Is this because they're fighting for the original Chinese interpretation of the book?
They don't like the fact that it's gone international, that some of the main protagonists are not Chinese or change gender or whatever, but also they hate something which is a little more political, which is at the opening scene in the Netflix version, as it is in the English translation of the novel, is a particularly violent scene from the Cultural Revolution, where one character's father is murdered on stage. And in the Chinese novel, that is buried in the middle for reasons
I
simply couldn't imagine. But
yes, okay, indeed. Of course, only having read the English version, I wasn't au fait with that.
So of course, the nationalists are kind of up in arms and jumping up and down and saying Westerners are destroying this precious cultural object. So.
Well, The Three-Body Problem, for those who aren't familiar with it, is a sort of strange kind of science fiction intergalactic political thriller. And I think somebody should probably make a political thriller out of our first story, which also has Chinese connections, because Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has accused China of meddling in the last two Canadian elections. And now, he made his allegations to a parliamentary committee set up to investigate suspicions of Chinese interference, but that was only after the opposition Conservative Party claimed they'd lost 9 seats in Parliament due to Beijing's interference. Now, it's not just the three-body problem that hasn't gone down well in China, Isabel. These allegations haven't either. China's embassy in Canada... Yeah. China's embassy in Canada says it strongly deplores and resolutely opposes the allegations. And do you know what? Sino-Canadian relationship, it's been bumpy, hasn't it, the past few years?
It hasn't been great. I mean, these the elections of which we speak, if you remember the background, was that my daughter of the founder of Huawei had been detained in Canada at the request of the United States for extradition. Then China, of course, detained as many Canadians as it could find. So that was four. Charged them with espionage. So we had a kind of mutual hostage standoff, which went on for some years until she was, in fact, released. But this is another complication. The other rather snooty remark that the embassy made was, frankly, we're not really interested in Canadian politics, which isn't very diplomatic. But it is kind of in line with Xi Jinping's conversation with Trudeau at a relatively recent meeting, when he was really quite dismissive and rude to Trudeau. So things are not good. But it isn't just Trudeau who's saying that there was interference. This is the Canadian Intelligence Service. And I would point out that, you know, Microsoft released a report last week, a very detailed report on Chinese cyber warfare, which it reveals that it is not just Canada that's been suffering this. The United States has also suffered it extensively. Australia and New Zealand have complained about it. The European Union has investigated allegations. So there seems to be a big uptick in Chinese cyber activity and increasing sophistication. They haven't really changed an outcome. They didn't change the outcome in Taiwan, for example, where they tried very hard. But there is an increased sophistication of the methodology.
Does Chinese interference explain Giorgio Meloni?
Well, we have had some interference in Italy too. But what you said before about this being like a thriller, absolutely, because the most interesting part of the story for me is that apparently in Canada they said, the damage was not neither party was damaged or both parties were, which is like a dystopic thriller in which, you know, a foreign power like China, you want to create chaos, you damage two parties in competition, so they each think that the other one is in bed with China, and then chaos erupts after that. So it's a perfect script for me for another thriller. But on a more serious point of view, I think this might be, because in the end it was like saying, I know nothing happened really, but something certainly did happen. The Secret Services never tell that everything that they know. This seems like, from what I've learned from the spying world, a warning to Canada, especially after the arrest of this manager, a warning to say, look what we could do if we wanted.
And frankly, it's not just China is doing it. I mean, I was looking at the headlines from my patch in former Yugoslavia this morning. There it is in Slovenia. The government websites are down. The Bank of Slovenia website is down due to suspected cyber attacks from Russia. Why? Well, a couple of weeks ago, Slovenia expelled a Russian diplomat for espionage.
Wow.
So, you know, again, it's as you say, Enrico, you know, this is what we can do if we choose to put our efforts into it. We can do this.
Absolutely. And Enrico's right about neither side in Canada is claiming that the election was substantially affected by it. But the misinformation and disinformation practices, the exacerbation of divisions in society, that's a real weapon. And in the Microsoft report, there were some rather startling examples. You may remember that terrible fire in Hawaii last year. There was a whole disinformation campaign from China blaming the US government for that. They said that they had exploded a weapon, you know, and that's the kind of thing that takes off on social media and breeds suspicion of the government. That's really good for China and Russia because it makes our politics even more dysfunctional. And that kind of thing is really ramping up in this election year.
Yeah, we've got a disinformation factory again. It's a funny old patch, Western Balkans, but things happen on it. And we have a disinformation factory in North Macedonia, of all places, which has been extremely active in the last US presidential election. And there are indications that it's been ramping up its activity. Again, I mean,
who's sponsoring that?
Now, that's a very good question, isn't it? They're not exactly they're not putting it on their websites. You know, disinformation sponsored
with warm thanks too. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are obvious conclusions to be drawn, bearing in mind where we are, the neighbourhood that we're in, and who gains from sowing chaos, not just as, for example, in US elections, but also the perceptions of what's going on in a Western Balkan country which wants to join NATO, as
exactly.
North Macedonia did at that time.
And the EU also.
Yeah. So to what extent are you feeling it in Italy, the pressure, Enrico, from bad state actors, shall we say?
Well, let's say that at one point the Meloni government seemed ready to have agreements with China that then, after pressure from the United States and other European allies, they have cancelled. And at the same way, parts of the coalition in Italy had a very good relationship, and someone say even financial support from Russia. But the Prime Minister Meloni is firmly on the Western side and against Russia in Ukraine and in other circumstances. So that's the story at this point.
I mean, it does seem to be quite a personal thing. Getting back to the original point about Justin Trudeau and China, this is it just my imagination, or has this become personal between, if I can say, him and China, but maybe him and Xi Jinping?
Well, certainly the personal chemistry between them that was on view, it's about 18 months ago now, was very bad. I mean, it's, you know, Xi Jinping may not be the most user-friendly politician in the world, but he isn't normally kind of
user-friendly
rude.
Politician, yes.
He's not normally rude, and he was quite dismissive of Trudeau.
Yes.
In public.
And then to see the opposition party actually being the ones to ask. I mean, this is quite funny because, you know, I don't think anybody was under any illusions about Justin Trudeau's feelings, relations, the sticky spots he'd been put in by China. And yet it's the opposition coming to him and asking him to set up this parliamentary commission.
Yes, but as Enrico says, I think it's not about who wins the election exactly. It's about damaging faith in elections altogether.
And in democracy in general.
Precisely.
Yes.
It's a grim game, and bearing in mind the number of elections.
It's a smart game at the same time from them. Very smart. Instead of helping one side, you just sow confusion and people say, oh my God, maybe autocracy is not so bad.
And this is a super election year, so we're going to have to keep an eye on this wherever we are, I feel, whichever side of the Atlantic and whichever side of the Pacific. But just stay in the European Union for a minute. This is one I've taken a bit personally for reasons which should be fairly obvious, but we can go into that in a moment if time allows. But the old EU migration and asylum arrangements didn't really make anybody happy, the old Dublin Agreement. So perhaps MPs are taking a bit of comfort after they passed a new deal that's raised hackles across the political spectrum. Parties on the left say the new regime that's been agreed upon is too tough. Those on the right say it's not tough enough. And meanwhile, more than 160 human rights organisations are horrified because they claim the deal will result in greater suffering, less protection and more rights violations for people who may very well be fleeing persecution or even life-threatening situations. Now, you know, this one, as I said, slightly personal because the Balkan route for refugees came directly through my path. I spent a lot of time on it and with people who were genuinely fleeing persecution, war, death, destruction, so on and so forth. On the other hand, Enrico, your country, Italy, very much on the front line of the migration crisis, the refugee crisis, and largely being left to it by the other 26 European Union countries, well, bar Greece, of course.
Well, when you are criticized by the right and by the left, you might think that you're doing the right thing. This is the simple wisdom that you can have. Of course, there is criticism from human rights organizations too, which is more credible. I'd like to take a step back and just say that, of course, the European Union is not perfect. And of course, there are a lot of fights and not all countries are doing what they are supposed to do. But if you compare with other international organizations, it's a great, great project. I mean, I was reading the other day about the UN. You know how the UN is not doing anything in Ukraine, the Middle East. It's a place where to govern. They have the five countries of a veto, two are dictatorships. Half of the members of the UN are not democracies. If you think of this European club where there is a long queue outside of the door of people knocking in because they want to enter, and the rules are you all have to be democracies and you all have to accept certain principles, is still very good. And this law is not perfect, might be a step. It might be a step toward a better future. Unfortunately, with populism, with all these problems we have today, it's difficult to pass a law in which everybody is happy. And we Italians know that because it's, like you said about the Balkans, it's on our path, we are the front line. We'll see if other countries will take responsibilities, but at least the law passed.
Do you think, Isabel, having looked at what's been passed, and, you know, still we have to always say with anything that's gone through the European Parliament, you've still got to have it agreed in council, but it having made its way through the Parliament, do you think that the people who are actually coming, whether it's up the Balkan route or across the Mediterranean or wherever it might be, that they're finding themselves in the European Union, are they being fully considered in this agreement that's been made, you know, remembering that they're all fellow human beings at the end of the day?
Well, they are being considered, but they're being balanced against a number of other considerations. And I think there are two big aspects to this. One is that the pressure of migration in Europe is both unevenly distributed. It falls on frontline states. And the states that are behind that front line haven't been terribly helpful, you know, and relatively unsympathetic to the burden sharing. But the second thing is that the whole issue of immigration, as we know, migration, has been weaponized by far-right groups, by populists. And we have, again, an election year.
Yeah, I mean, the timing of this deal is perhaps unfortunate, isn't it?
Well, I mean, in a way, it could be seen as an effort to defuse the situation before it results in far-right populists winning making substantial electoral gains in France, in Germany, in, you know, a number of countries. So I think that, of course, it's not perfect. It's tough. I don't think Europe can take all the people who want to come. If this arrangement prioritizes asylum seekers, people fleeing persecution, then good. If it processes people more quickly without losing justice, also good, because I think the delays and the backlog are also very damaging. And I think it's tricky. There is no perfect answer here.
Yeah, there isn't. I mean, you know, when we come down to brass tacks, there is a definition of who is a refugee. There's a International Refugee Convention, and every member of the European Union is a signatory to that convention. So they're supposed to respond to that. And one would hope that these asylum processing centres that they're setting up, and this again, Enrico, makes me think of what the arrangement Italy has made with Albania, that, you know, the idea is to have, in essence, an offshore processing centre for people's asylum claims. So to what degree are we confident that these processing centres, which sounds, you know, a bit grim talking about processing centre for human beings, but still, to these processing centres, are they going to be assessing people's asylum claims according to the international convention?
I could say I would have more trust in Albania than Rwanda, first of all. And second, this is, in my view, for Italy, at least, more symbolic than practical.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a small number of people, isn't it, really? 3,000.
Yes, it's really, again, a way to say, we're doing something. You see, we are fighting migration as we promised we did because we are a nationalist, racist party, but this is not going to solve the problem.
Yeah, indeed it isn't. And again, it's an election year. We were talking about weaponizing the issue, not weaponizing the issue. You were nodding your assent when Isabel was talking about maybe this being a preempting of it, Enrico. But are you confident, bearing in mind the turnout tends to be very low in European elections, that the right won't still be able to use this as a way to motivate their supporter base?
You mean the centres in Albania or the law, the European law?
The new law, that as the European Union being weak on migration.
Well, not necessarily the party of government in Italy. Maybe some of the coalition, but the big party, the Giorgio Meloni party, the Brothers of Italy, they will say they are more or less happy with it, in my view. They are going probably to win the elections anyway, because of the dysfunction of the center-left. They're all fighting among each other, so that might not be the biggest issue.
And a quick verdict from you, Isabel, before we move on.
Well, I think that actually we haven't got there yet. We couldn't it could take some time for this to get through the council. I mean, what is Hungary going to try to extract for the as a price? You know, what is this is weaponized already, and it the game is being played in the council as well as at the ballot box.
Indeed, it is. Well, let's move on from Europe and go somewhere. Well, it's not intergalactic, but at least it's outside the atmosphere. We were talking about the Biden-Kishida bromance on yesterday's edition of the Monocle Daily. And the US president appears to have delivered quite a gift to Japan's prime minister. And that is the chance to be the first non-American to walk on the moon. And of course, I don't mean that's going to be Fumio Kishida doing the walking on the moon, but it will be a lucky Japanese astronaut who joins one of NASA's forthcoming Artemis lunar missions. And as part of the deal, Japan's space agency will design and develop a moon rover for the occasion. Now, we started the program by talking about this intergalactic, you know, political thriller. Is this now proof, do you think, Isabel, that lunar exploration is the new war by other means?
Well, I think certainly space is the new domain. And that's been pretty clear. I think diplomatically, this is going to enrage the Chinese. Ooh. Because this is going to happen a couple of years before a Chinese lands on the moon. And, you know, the Chinese have been making much of their accomplishments in space recently. So it's part of a realignment in East Asia that is really gathering pace. Japan's posture has changed substantially. It's spending more on defence. It's striking really interesting deals on advanced defence equipment with the UK, with Australia, with France. I mean, it is really coming out as a player in the region for the first time since in the post-war period. A bit as Germany has been forced to, although rather more slowly and reluctantly. But Japan is definitely on the front foot on this. And I think this is an absolute blinder of a PR coup, frankly.
What do you make of it, Enrico?
Well, I have something to tell to this Japanese astronaut who will go. It will be the first non-American to go to the moon because I interviewed the first man who went to the moon.
Oh!
Neil Armstrong.
Seriously?
And he had something to say that could give this Japanese guy an idea what he's looking forward to. Because at one point, of course, I asked him, where did he get the inspiration for the famous phrase, a small step for man, a giant leap for humanity? And he told me, I thought of it while I was going down the ladder.
Yes.
I couldn't believe it. And he said, come on, at the last moment. But then he explained to me that while the lunar capsule was going down, lots of things were going wrong aboard. A lot.
Yes.
And he said we had 50% chances of crashing and 50% chances of making it. So he said, what I was going to say was the last thought on my mind. I say this because even though the technology has improved a lot, of course, it's a big leap, to quote Armstrong, to go to the moon. And so, bravo to this Japanese guy.
I think that's worth celebrating. I'm tempted to just focus on the political, diplomatic aspect of it. But, that's fair
enough.
It's
exciting.
And, I was too young to see the first moon landings, and there have been none since, which is very frustrating. And I have seen the film Apollo 11, which has all of the footage from the time, which apparently had been dumped in a skip or something. Seriously. I mean, have you seen that one? They restored it. They did an IMAX version of it, all the rest of it. And it was, as you said, when the lunar lander was coming into the moon's surface, it was petrifying. You realised the edge that they were on. And, of course, they were not going to pull back from that edge.
Since the entire world was watching.
Well, and also it's what they trained for, and it's what they were in it, absolutely willing to put their lives on the line for.
And the race they had with the USSR, of course. So
I'm enormously jealous that you met and interviewed Neil Armstrong.
Well, yeah.
You've made me professionally jealous in Midori House.
Well, perhaps you better book in your appointment with the Japanese astronaut and make up for it.
Indeed. I hadn't I? I mean, can you see, again, you were talking about Japan. If we can just go back to the diplomatic aspect of it a bit, Isabel. You know, we're talking about Japan poking China a bit here. Is there a danger that it might get a bit of a prod in response?
Possibly. But, you know, it's hard to respond without looking totally sour, isn't it? It's hard to respond without pointing up the fact that your own moon landing is going to be 4 years after this one. So it's quite tricky. I mean, the Chinese have rather overstated their relationship with space anyway. Mm. I mean, there was I gave a small talk on nine things about truths about China which are not true, and one of them is the claim that the Chinese made that the Great Wall is the only man-made structure that can be seen from space. It's just not true. And when they finally got someone up into space and he was asked on return, did you see the Great Wall? It was all rather embarrassing. So I think they may well want to respond, but I think they ought to pause and think and do it a little more subtly.
Indeed. And the lunar rover, is this Japan finally catching up on what it needs to do in terms of electric vehicles, having been lagging behind Japan? Could be, couldn't it? Have we exhausted Japan and the moon, or is there something more you want to say, Enrico?
Maybe.
I mean, I'm happy to talk about the moon all you like. Tom's saying, wrap it up. But I'm not allowed to talk more moon, Tom. No, I'm not. We have to go into different
okay,
kinds of.
All right.
We have to do different kinds.
Let's
of...
Let's go la dolce vita then.
Yes, this is it. Different kinds of nomads now, and of the digital variety. Because if the world is already a digital nomad's oyster, it's now also their risotto al nero di seppia. Because Italy is opening its doors to people who travel the globe with their laptops and tell everyone they're working. Honest. Its digital nomad visa is now in effect after years of a debate. So, will it be Rimini or Roma? Trieste or Turin? The choices, Enrico, are almost overwhelming, are they not?
Yes, absolutely. I just watched a wonderful series on Netflix called Ripley, where
oh wow,
which takes place all over Italy, and if one watches it, it's like a huge advertising for moving there.
Yeah,
you might not want him as a digital nomad.
Not with him.
I've been reading nothing but Patricia Highsmith for the past few months, incidentally. So you've hit the right chord there, straight off. And yeah, we were in Rome a couple of weeks ago, Venice for the Carnivale earlier this year. I mean, I'm sold already.
Yeah, not too bad. But it was about time, I mean, that Italy did something like that.
Mm.
It was about time because other countries that have supposedly less to offer have already done that for a long time. For example, Finland, which I respect a lot, of course, but it is the happiest country in the world that has been there for 6 or 7 years, rightly so. But the first thing you think when move to Finland to be a digital nomad, it's cold, maybe the food, all the things that we in Italy already have ready answers for. The difference is that I think Finland had a program called Be a Finn for a Month. Come, try for everything if you like. And all these high-tech guys and girls then stay.
Yeah.
Because they find it surprisingly, everybody speaks English, the food is not so bad. In Helsinki, it's not actually as cold in Lapland. And so they say, this is great. No crime, good schools, good hospitals. I have the fear that if we did the same in Italy, be in Italian for a month, people would come with great expectation, fantastic, after we saw Ripley, say, oh, and then after a month, they say, the bureaucracy, this doesn't work, strikes after strike, the internet Wi-Fi is bad, I go back.
You were highlighting that the conditions were a little bit, perhaps, the bar was being set quite high, Isabel, for digital nomads.
Yes, I mean, you have to demonstrate that you have healthcare. You have to earn three times the minimal level required for exemption from participation in healthcare costs, and that's around 28,000 euros a year. So
and this is presumably per person as well, one would think.
Per person. And you also have to have been a digital nomad or a remote worker somewhere else for 6 months. So no novices need apply.
Yeah, it's like that old gag about, you know, you can't have a job unless you've got
you
experience.
You have a job, yes. Exactly. So it is a bit, you know, it's not immediately obvious that you can drop everything and kind of, you know, rush off with your laptop. But my problem with imagining this, and I love Italy, but, you know, most of the cafes don't have a lot of seating. They're mostly standing at the bar. So where are these digital nomads going to work?
Well, they better get a flat, for sure. But all that said, I mean, cappuccino, pizza, yeah. Not.
It's not too bad.
It's the sea, the sand, the mountains. I mean, if you're a writer or if you're a creative profession, Not too bad.
I mean, seriously, I'm already thinking, well, you know, I'm in Ljubljana. That's not very far from Trieste. I could, I like Trieste. I could just go there. I'm sure I could cover my patch from there. And, you know, I've got both Illy and Hausbrandt right on the doorstep there, so the coffee's already taken care of. It's got a decent little airport, flights around Italy from there. You know, I'm sold, frankly.
There is a bit of irony, though, in that, you know, countries trying to encourage digital nomads to arrive while erecting barriers against asylum seekers.
Indeed.
We are categorizing human beings rather differently.
This is one paradox. The other paradox is that they want digital nomad to come, but why all the young Italians want to leave Italy?
Yep.
Question mark.
And we also have this issue on my patch in Croatia, which has got a very good digital nomad deal. They'll let you in for a year and they won't charge you any tax while you're there, which is, you know, very tempting, let's face it. But young Croatians, as people will find out when we have the Eurovision Song Contest next month, we'll find out, because the Eurovision Song Contest entry for Croatia is all about young people leaving. And they've been leaving in their droves, particularly since Croatia joined the EU. So some of these countries are actually
emptying out.
Yep, and they're desperate to get people in. Now, are people going to be tempted, as you say, be a Finn for a month, be a Croat for a year, be an Italian for a renewable year, as long as you've got some experience beforehand? Is it going to work?
Well, we'll see. But anyway, not to end on a negative note, I think it's worth that they try to do this. It shows that they understand how the world works.
As you love Italy, which one would you pick? Which place in Italy, Isabel?
Oh, gosh, it's wonderfully appealing. I'd probably be very British and go to Tuscany.
Fair dues. That sounds about right to me. I'm going to get a glass of Brunello di Montalcino to toast that right about now, I think. But it's time now for our weekly letter from, and this time we're off to Milan, with Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho.
A reassuring sight and sound to residents of Milan is the city's venerable fleet of white and yellow Pentotto trams, a model that has been in service since 1928. 100-odd vehicles still run through the city's downtown, sporting well-worn wooden benches and glass lamps inside. Their classic design makes them much loved, and soon many will be crowding into these trusty trams as they traverse the city in search of the latest and greatest furniture, as it's springtime and Milan is gearing up to host yet another edition of Salon del Mobile, the world's largest fair dedicated to design. For newcomers, Milan Design Week can best be summed up as a spectacle. Over 300,000 visitors turn up. Many are furniture buyers, dealers, and design students, and the city adopts a carnival-like atmosphere. Unlike Fashion Week, the design fair actually engages with the city. The public are welcome to drop in and see the latest creations for the home, which often go beyond furniture, as companies involved in household appliances and building materials, think decorative tiles, get in on the action. Much of the fun at Salon del Mobile actually happens away from the main fairgrounds, which today sit on the edge of the city. Locals and passing tourists have a chance to visit the many venues. They're what's called Fuori Salone, hundreds of off-site events scattered across the city, hosted in stately palazzos, museums and courtyards, or even in tiny retail shops that are taken over for a week by, say, a startup brand from Denmark that makes ceramic vases in Portugal. From morning to night, in sleek showrooms and in storefronts, there are countless events, usually well-catered, so design enthusiasts can sip coffee or Prosecco and nibble on bite-sized treats, so they never go hungry. For the uninitiated, a few tips on how to maneuver through this maze of activities. To get around town, descend into the metro, where you can admire the 1960s signage and interior layout created by two notable names, Italian designer Franco Albini and Dutch graphic designer Bob Noorda. Remember, some 2,000 brands show at Milan Design Week, be they the big established Italian players, like Bolfi Kitchens or B&B Italia with their sofas, and also the fledgling startups. It's best to pick a neighborhood and just wander. All the while, you can admire the built environment around you, Joe Ponti's Pirelli skyscraper, or Stefano Boeri's new vegetation-covered Bosco Verticale apartment towers. Beauty is on display everywhere, and it's not just chairs and sofas. Fans of illumination need to locate Corso Montfort on the map, where you'll find a row of showrooms dedicated to lighting, with lamp designs, many of which feel as if they've arrived from the future. There's whimsical Artemide, run by the brilliant Carlotta di Bevilacqua, and the very promising Nemo Lighting, headed up by Federico Palazzari. You'll walk away inspired and invigorated, and no doubt be ready to return for next year's edition of Salon del Mobile.
And I'm sure he'll be there as well. That's Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho. Well, that's all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Isabel Hilton and Enrico Franceschini. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Guy Delorne here in London. The Monocle Daily is back with me at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.